Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is the Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the Mystic.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. I continue to read from my memoir, Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. In this episode, the second of three parts of the final chapter, I join with others to put our principles into action. Civil disobedience had never come naturally to me or easily. But these principles weren't about ideas. They were about real people. And that made all the difference. So, strapping on our armor, it's into the breach.
Just like way back in the days of old. And together we will flow as we sail into the Mystic. Come on, come on.
The young couple sat with Christine, Anna, and me in Christine's kitchen. They wanted to talk about getting married. The three of us were all priests in the diocese. Ordinarily, one priest would do. But this case was different. Christine fed us a hearty bowl of chili with fresh bread and generous glasses of red wine. We were warmed by the food and drink and by the flow of the conversation. But the mood remained tense and tentative. We weren't quite there yet. I knew Jill, one half of the couple, through youth work she did in the diocese. She was blonde and blue-eyed and full of youthful energy herself, a natural fit as a youth worker. Her partner Gio, a social worker, had dark eyes that could suddenly sparkle or spark, betraying a fierce intelligence. Gio presented more boyishly, with fashionably short hair and a lumberjack shirt. They were two attractive, competent, and self-possessed young adults, and very much in love. We all knew that in the Calgary Diocese in 2016, a church marriage for Jill and Gio was not possible, at least not according to the books. The National Church had just passed by one vote the first of two readings of a motion at General Synod to permit same-sex blessings in the Anglican Church of Canada. Some bishops across the country said they weren't waiting any longer. Justice demanded action, and they were going ahead in their diocese with same-sex marriages, not just blessings, but not Calgary. We wanted to find a way to do it anyway. 2 years before that meeting in the kitchen, the parish council at St. Stephen's was ready for a new challenge. We had completed our renovations, we had extended our outreach, we had updated our worship. Now, how could we move the church forward, the diocese in particular, toward the church's full inclusion of people from across the spectrum of sexual orientation and gender identification? That included marriage for all. This was not a stretch for us. When I arrived at St. Stephen's, the church was already offering sanctuary, quite literally, to non-straight Christians who had been shunned or vilified by their own churches. Under the banner of Integrity, a national coalition of gay and lesbian Anglicans, soon to be expanded to represent a broader range of sexual identifications, the group met for monthly worship and fellowship at our church on a Sunday evening. The parish screened films for the public on the topic of sexuality and the church. The first, For the Bible Tells Me So, a documentary about Christians coming out of the closet, including Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson, attracted over 200 people. Some of them rose to the microphone afterward, in tears, to say how grateful they were. They never imagined finding themselves back in a church again. We invited John Spong to give a lecture at St. Stephen's. A renegade Episcopalian bishop from Newark, New Jersey, Spong was an outspoken advocate for an intelligent, non-literal reading of Scripture and for the marriage and ordination of qualified people regardless of sex or gender. Our initiatives attracted praise and support from churches who felt less free themselves to address these issues in public. But we also attracted the crazies. The Sunday following our showing of For the Bible Tells Me So, a woman showed up at St. Stephen's at the conclusion of our main morning service. She stood at the back as the congregation left, targeting people she thought looked gay and handing them a CD of her own pastor's sermon on the subject, contradicting whatever they were hearing from me. Religious tracts were dropped through our mail slot from time to time when no one was around. They were black and white comic book storyboards depicting what happened to people who didn't believe what the Bible said about homosexuality. It wasn't pretty. One regular caller left messages for me on the church phone. He always began the same way, more or less measured and reasonable, drawing my attention to the errors of a liberal theology. But his voice picked up speed and volume as he went along, especially as he began quoting the applicable scriptures, homosexuality as an abomination, men turning to men as to women. After a few minutes, he was audibly out of his skin, shouting into the phone his closing line, "Read your Bible, Pastor!" before slamming the receiver down. But the worst were the picketers from Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas. I don't know how they'd even heard of us, but they did us the small courtesy of letting us know by fax that they were coming to pay us a visit on an upcoming Sunday morning. We arranged for a police presence and tried to carry on as usual as the group marched in front of our church, singing songs to Jesus and carrying signs that read, "God hates fags," and "Your preacher is lying to you." One sign took the form of a flip chart counter that showed the number of days murdered gay man Matthew Shepard had been burning in hell. Not his murderers, him. Bishop Spong himself, because of his well-publicized views, had required that we hire two off-duty police officers to ensure his safety on the night of his lecture. He pointed out that all the abuse he suffered for his liberal views, from death threats to tongue lashings to the woman who walked forward as he sat in the front row of his own wife's funeral and hit him with her umbrella, all these were Christians. So we felt ready to take on the Christians who stood in our way. Whatever their personal piety, we weren't calling their faith into question. We were asking for justice. If they didn't want to marry gay people in their churches, that was their business. But no one should presume to stop us from doing it in our own church. It was called, in Anglican diocese that adopted this approach, local option. Let each congregation decide for itself. After slipping and sliding for several years on the issue, Bishop Kerr Wilson finally issued a formal statement. The Diocese of Calgary, he said, had not moved beyond its intention to follow a path of gracious restraint in regard to same-sex relationships. Nor, in his view, had there been any conscientious theological and scriptural study in the wider church on the subject to change his mind. Furthermore, any action on his part to permit same-sex blessings for parishes offering to do so would constitute a breach of trust with those parishes that were opposed. Therefore, he concluded, "Public rites of same-sex blessings are not permitted and may not be performed by those under the license of the Bishop of Calgary." Our parish council invited him to a meeting to have a chat. Each member offered their view, their experience, and their feelings on the matter. One mother pleaded tearfully for the church to offer something hopeful to her children so they might remain in the church. One member talked about his devastating personal experience as a gay man, unable to have his civil marriage blessed by his own church. another mother revealed that her child, born a girl, had begun the process of changing their gender. She hoped the church was going to be able to walk with her child on this complex and courageous journey. When everyone had their say, attention fell on the bishop. What was his rationale for denying same-sex couples the church's blessing? We asked. It was complicated, he said, having to do with our understanding of God's intentions in creation. But he reassured the group that one of his best friends, Gord, was gay. Gord had even been living under Greg's own roof when he came out, fearing his friend's judgment. On the contrary, Greg still very much loved his friend, even if he could not sanction his relationship with another man. And that's all we got. We weren't considered worthy of a theological defense because it would have been complicated. Instead, we got a folksy tale about the bishop's gay friend, Gord. This was useful? How? People wanted more. But the bishop floated above it all, unfazed, deflecting criticism until it was time for him to go. I accompanied him to the door. My friends had spoken so well, so clearly, and so passionately. I was proud of them. They're good people, you know, I said to him. Their hearts are in the right place. The bishop smiled at me as if I were a child. Yes, he said. But there's more to it than that, isn't there? Then he left. We weren't sure what to do after that. He was the bishop, and for the moment, it seemed that he held all the cards. But then Jill and Gio appeared, breaking bread and drinking wine with Christine, Anna, and me. Had the time for talk come to an end? Was it time to act? The three of us looked at each other. We decided it was.
One more day before the storm,
I follow where she goes.
At the barricades of freedom,
shall I join my brothers there?
When our ranks begin to fall,
do I stay?
Take your place with me.
The church at its best embodies a possibility, a hope of what the world could be like. This is what I saw the Sunday morning John the Judge shared a pew with Peter the bipolar street person. This is what I saw most weeks when a line of communicants approached to receive the sacrament, a fragment of warm bread pressed into the palm of their hands, and a sip of sweet wine, each one receiving the moment with gratitude, as a sacred gift, as nourishment for their journey. Sometimes I would look out at the congregation and I'd want to say, "People, just look at you. Beautiful creatures of God. Each one of you, unique and special, with your own gifts to share with the world, your own light to shine." I felt an overwhelming sense of awe that the world was such an extravagant place, and that these people, my people, marvelous in their diverse humanity, were a sign of that extravagance. The same feeling washed over me at the wedding of Jill and Gio. The congregation that gathered at St. Stephen's that day included the family members of the couple, supporters from the church and beyond, and also a wonderful menagerie of people representing, so far as I could tell, the entire spectrum of sexual orientation and gender identity. Jill, who identified as female, looked every inch the traditional bride, in a white, full-length gown with a lace bodice. Gio, who identified as transgender, non-binary, chose a dark suit and tie with a deep claret-colored brocade vest. Their flushed faces glowed with happiness. Gone were the usual theatrics associated with a wedding. The bride wound up tight and ready to spin out of control. The groom doing what he was told. The overbearing mother. The pushy photographers. It seemed everyone knew why they were there, and it wasn't about the show. Jill and Gio had both suffered a long and difficult journey to get to this moment. First, to find and to accept themselves for who they were. Then, to find one another. and now to find themselves here in an Anglican church in the Diocese of Calgary against all odds for their wedding. Most of their friends likely could have told similar stories of similar journeys, but not many of them ending at a similar place. It was a risk for all of us to be there. It could cost me my job, as it could for the other five priests who stood with me. It could stigmatize St. Stephen's within the diocese, isolating us further from the more conventional congregations. But no one took a greater risk that day than Jill and Gio. The church had hurt them by rejecting them not for their beliefs or for their actions, but for who they were at their core. On this day, prophetically, they were asking the church to live up to its own standards and give their marriage God's blessing. But prophets are not without honor, except in their hometown. It grieved me, after the fact, to learn that their re-engagement with the church for their wedding, despite the willing support of those of us involved in the service, had only reset the trauma button for Jill and Gio. They knew we were breaking the rules to marry them, and they were grateful for our efforts on their behalf. But what was wrong with a world and with a church where there were rules set against them in the first place, rules that could result in clergy getting fired for the unconscionable act of blessing their relationship? Not only that, but the entire framework was wrong. The focus of our ongoing struggle within the diocese was specifically same-sex blessings. These were the words of a straight world casting the wondrous spectrum of sexual identity as an A or B choice, male or female. But were Jill and Gio really a same-sex couple? Their identities were far more complex than that, transcending the usual binary categories. They were Jill and Gio, unique human beings whose categorization as male or female only served to diminish them and to deny them the full expression of their humanity. Despite the joy of their wedding day, they found it all deeply disturbing. Six priests participated in the service. I officiated, Irene Pfeiffer, a sympathetic marriage commissioner who also happened to be an active Anglican laywoman, presided over the legal parts, so there could be no contest after the fact about the legality of the ceremony. Then all six of us clergy stepped forward to pronounce the nuptial blessing. We extended a hand and said the words in unison, the one thing we were expressly prohibited from doing. The focus of the marriage ceremony was, of course, Jill and Gio. But at the reception that followed, their close-knit community came to the fore to express its diversity in a full array of gender identities. We were greeted at the door by their friends, whose dress was as creative and original as they were themselves, funky, ambiguous, playful, often colorful, and we were served our meals by servers who wore name tags bearing their preferred pronouns, he, she, or they. At first, it was unsettling. I was on guard against getting the pronouns wrong. I had to make a conscious effort to move beyond my own binary thinking. Was my server a male becoming a female, or vice versa, or something else? But then, as the evening worked its magic, I just let go, and none of it mattered anymore. I felt strangely liberated. Questions of precise sexual identification simply fell away, and we relaxed into this sea of diversity as if we had all come home to a place where categories no longer mattered, where we could be whoever we were and wear whatever we wanted and love whomever we chose, without question marks hanging over our heads. The feeling would prove short-lived, of course. We had had to keep the service quiet. We didn't want word to get out so the bishop could stop us from proceeding. Instead, the six clergy had prepared a statement he would receive in his office on the Monday following the service, explaining our actions and the reasons behind them. Jean and I returned home from the reception, feeling full and happy. It had been a good day, a momentous day. As we were getting undressed, I checked my phone. There was a message. It was from the bishop, asking me to call him and leaving his home number. It was late. I wasn't ready to burst the bubble and let go of all the warm associations of the day. That could wait until tomorrow. I've been reading from Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. I'm grateful you're still with me. The themes I've been exploring in this chapter may well strike a nerve for you from your own life and experience. If so, feel free to leave a post on the Facebook group The Mystic Cave, or write me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. In the next penultimate episode, the consequences of our irregular action are dispensed at a meeting with the bishop and the chancellor, his legal advisor. Stay with me. We're almost there. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. It's too late to stop now.